Welcome to the Omfer podcast.
Hello and welcome to the OMFIF podcast. My name is Pierre Orlieb. I'm head of policy analysis in the Economic and Monetary Policy Institute at OMFIF. Today I'm speaking to Scott Grimberg. He's an emerging market fixed income portfolio manager at CalPERS, one of the largest public pension funds in the world. Scott and I are speaking about the broader state of play in emerging markets, their policy responses to the COVID shock, the ways in which ESG criteria can be integrated into emerging market fixed income investments, and a lot more. It's a really fascinating conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. So, Scott, thank you for joining us today. Before we kind of dive into some of the weeds and the deeper issues in that space, in that asset class, I just want to get a sense. In March 2020, you're sitting at CalPERS, and the COVID shock kind of hits financial markets. There's the policy response that unfolds over the course of a couple of weeks. What were your thoughts on that period, on the policy responses, and on kind of that time as a market participant?
Well, I would say firstly, thank you for having me on this podcast. In March 2020, I think we were entering markets like many investors into the emerging market space. You know, maybe probably somewhat light on emerging markets, just not because of any particular outlook on, say, you know, we had any idea that there would be this COVID shock or anything. More, maybe a little bit what was happening in China at the time was giving us a little edge, but that's about it. I think what happened was it was just the values had been squeezed. And what you saw in the markets and markets, but honestly over the subsequent months, was emerging market assets are treated as any other risk asset class. There were significant sell-offs, liquidity collapsed, et cetera. And as a result, you saw these, you know, enormous drawdowns at the top line. I think, well, one of the more interesting factors is emerging markets may retain some liquidity that, say, you know, equivalent U.S. corporate or high yield markets did not, but that's not to say they were liquid. It's to say they just did slightly better than, you know, the equivalent rated markets. In fact, the only thing that retained any kind of running liquidity was probably U.S. treasuries and maybe Chinese government bonds. Outside of that, we saw, you know, this massive risk off trade. The subsequent policy response from the U.S. side was obviously much more significant than anything we saw, at least initially in emerging markets, because, well, as an emerging market specialist, you know that there are limits to the fiscal and financial capacities of many of these countries to respond to these kinds of super exogenous shocks. That said, they were able to piggyback to a certain extent off the U.S. reaction. What subsequently happened over the following 3 to 4 months was almost a textbook case of a post-crisis response and the subsequent reaction by risk assets in these countries. In other words, like 2008 crisis and the fallout, what we witnessed was a non-emerging market shock, or not specifically emerging market shock, I should say. It was a global shock. It rippled across risk markets. The policy responses stemmed that tide and reversed the flow, so to speak. And emerging markets behaved exactly like they did in the post-2008 crisis, which was they recovered dramatically because of the developed market policy stimulus and the economic stimulus. They were able to capitalize on that recovery. I think this other factor there, of course, was the dramatic response in China. Again, this is very similar to what happened in 2008. And so as a result, the underpinnings of the marketplace, particularly the economic marketplace, managed to survive March and early April 2020 and recovered over the following few months. So it was more or less a confirmation of, you know, this is another risk market. This is not anything, you know, particularly challenged to exogenous or global shock. Like it would behave and did behave like every other risk market would behave.
It did behave like sort of a classic risk asset, as you say. But one of the things that I've been seeing when I speak to sort of central bank reserves managers or other public investors, so we work specifically with like the sovereign investment community. One of the things that I've been seeing, is that there has been like specific enthusiasm and a lot more of that enthusiasm for emerging market fixed income, right? So, I mean, you know, you see that especially among reserves managers whom fixed income is like, they want to move up the risk curve, but stay within kind of a comfortable space and get, somewhat higher yield pickup. So, I mean, from your perspective, is that something you've seen as well? Sort of a lot more appetite for EM fixed income over the past sort of, I don't know, 18 months? And if so, what do you think are kind of the drivers behind just that extra push in appetite for this particular risk asset?
Well, I think there's been a push for any kind of yieldy asset. And so in the immediate crisis, you had this, you know, enormous spreads across the high-risk markets with EM having a lot of spread availability to it. So coupled with the dramatic collapse of Treasury yields. So if you look at where U.S. Treasury yields are, went to and remained, because remember, we were in a tightening, we were in a kind of a quasi-tightening cycle prior. The collapse in yields forced investors, not just, you know, pension funds and endowments, but also reserve managers into higher risk asset classes just to maintain return targets or just to maintain return abilities even. So as a result, and as the spreads have maintained across all, I mean, let's be frank, across all spread markets, you saw this dramatic jump in demand. Dramatic, you know, and from both reserve managers, for instance, the shift from U.S. treasuries into U.S. corporates, also from non-typical invest in emerging markets to increase their exposure to emerging markets. I think what we saw, especially in the second half of 2020, was a crossover shift. In other words, the managers, the funds or the investors who might take a piece of emerging markets not only increase that allocation, but go deeper into the risk spectrum. And so go down to the single B space, for instance. I think that was a very interesting phenomenon, and I think that's going to continue. Right now, if you look at the U.S. pension fund universe, I don't think anyone created their investment targets and models, which are, and quite honestly, their return needs, which weren't created today, they were created many years ago. They weren't based on a 1.5% U.S. Treasury. They're based on a 4% U.S. Treasury. So the, you know, we like to joke, the return needs came down 100 basis points while the Treasury yield came down 500 basis points. So as a result, investors are forced into these higher risk assets because, and here's the trick, one thing emerging markets still represent, emerging market dollar fixed income, for instance, is liquidity. Now, it's not U.S. treasuries. It's not really even mortgages, but it does have significant liquidity over competitive markets. And in the U.S. dollar market, one of the more interesting phenomenons to me was in late April 2020, Panama issued a very large dollar bond and they gave up an enormous premium. That bond was massively oversubscribed. And in fact, it just started running up in price. And what you saw, despite the wider bid offer spreads, despite the illiquidity, were these massive bid cover ratios for new issuance out of emerging markets. That implies not only are investors retaining focus on the class, but they're increasing it. Moreover, with the return needs still embedded, they haven't diminished. The emerging market fixed income, for instance, and to an even greater extent, emerging market equities, simply put, attracted a lot more capital and still continues to attract capital and offer those spread premiums. And that's what investors are focused on right now. We think those spread premiums that are available. The only fly in the ointment there, of course, is local markets and emerging markets, which have not done nearly as well. Now there's a lot of reasons for that, and we can go into that if you like. You know, what was going on in those markets and why they're still under pressure. But certainly in the dollar markets, let's call it the hard currency markets, there's still an enormous amount of attraction and still an enormous amount of interest. I think the other sub-phenomenon of that is, of course, what's happened in China, or rather you may have people have noticed that there's been a dramatic increase in the interest in Chinese government bonds denominated in CNY, denominated renminbi. That's because of the availability of spread. And unlike, see, we don't view China as an emerging market in the same way. Unlike what happened with spread credit risk markets or spread markets or you know, let's call it risk assets, in March, April 2020, Chinese government bonds actually rallied. They behave more like U.S. treasuries than almost any other risk asset. And so to the extent that we can consider those less of a risk asset, now the CNY actually rallied during that period. As a result, what we've seen is across the board, investors get more involved with Chinese government bonds. And I think that's one of the sub-phenomenons that has become very, very interesting as well.
I want to kind of unpack a couple of things you mentioned. The first, the soft versus hard currency assets. Why don't we kind of go into that a little bit? So you were saying that it's the sort of specific, the dollar issuances, the foreign currency issuances that have performed best. Why is that? And how do you kind of evaluate the two different fixed income asset classes as an investor? How do you think about those?
Well, the way we think about it in general are two separate investment structures. And in reality, we tend to look at the local assets, more or less of a more of an equity type structure, right? Because, you know, the FX volatility tends to dominate the picture quite a bit. Now, that goes into some of the flow issues and some of the investment issues, what we've seen. But if you look at, if you start looking at like local fixed income in emerging markets as more of an equity type risk structure and sitting with your equity risk, it allows you to understand why that might not have performed quite as well and why investors might have preferred hard currency. The second part of that, of course, is that, you know, hard currency is essentially a dollar asset. It's a credit asset. And so the overall picture was returns followed duration. So returns in general followed the low yields lower in U.S. treasuries and other dollar-based assets. The spread markets more or less, you know, recovered to sort of a stable frame. And it's easier for investors, particularly hard currency investors from the U.S. and Europe, to invest in hard currency assets. It's they're all, even with the growth of your clearable local issue, hard currency assets trade and structure exactly like any other hard currency asset. So Mexican dollar bonds or Brazilian dollar bonds look more like a U.S. asset than do, say, the M-Bonos or the NTNs. And so it's much, much easier. You don't really need a whole lot of specialty to create a portfolio of hard currency emerging market dollar assets. Okay. But what happened with the local markets? I think there's three things there. One, you know, in the hard currency, because of the attraction duration, we did see the economic impact filter through. And so what we've been watching is a deterioration of credit outlooks for many emerging markets. That has less of an impact on the dollar markets. Not that it has no impact, but has a lesser impact because of the enormous demand from the flow, from the carry. However, in local markets, you had a couple things going on that actually negatively impacted those markets. One, there's a limit to the policy responses available to emerging market governments. In other words, there's a limit to their fiscal, financial, and policy capacity to support the market in the case of this enormous exogenous shock, right? And most emerging markets, if you talk to most emerging market central banks, they draw a sharp distinction. I think Banxico, then the Bank of Mexico, is most clear about this. There's a difference between policy and policy response between exogenous shock, what we can't control, and endogenous shock, what we can control. As a result, their initial policy response to cut interest rates, to support, to let the currencies go, this was a logical response to an exogenous shock that they had no control over. In other words, it would be unreasonable to expect any of these central banks to stand in front of sharp depreciations of the currency because it was not an endogenous shock that was causing these depreciations. It was purely exogenous. And they recognize, by and large, there's a limit to what they can do about that. The fallout from that, however, was this deterioration of returns to emerging market equities, at least initially, and emerging market local fixed income. Increasingly, the emerging market equities managed to recover as a reflection of global equity market recoveries, but currencies remained under pressure. And what we still see is a collapse of, say, the real yield construct, which supports a local market flow. Now, that's just starting to recover now. The third problem of that, and as we went over, is the economic fallout and policy response, the lack of ability to sort of stem that flow, and the lack of a appropriate policy response. In other words, would not have been a good idea to stem that flow. The third part is, where are we now? What is the effect of these currency weaknesses and what's going on in developed markets, which, of course, is like what everybody's talking about with the developed markets, particularly the U.S., is this inflation increase. Now, central banks in emerging markets, by and large, recognize where that inflationary pressure is coming from. It's not coming from, you know, a sudden collapse in their output gaps. Their output gaps remain very high. So they're in a market squeeze, right? With high output gaps, naturally you would hold interest rates down and let the currency weaken. Unfortunately, the old phenomena of lack of inflation pass-through from weaker currency is not working right now. You can see it's not working in Mexico. It's not working in Brazil. It's not working in China, for that matter, but it's definitely not working in countries with high import bills and or commodity import dependence. So as a result, many central banks are forced to raise interest rates right now. And you can see that the emerging market central banks are definitely on the forefront of raising rates, right? You know, Brazil, Mexico probably soon, whether it's South Africa, just Russia. Go through the list and you see they're raising rates, and the reason is always the same. They're raising rates not because their economies are recovering. There is growth and we expect more of that. But the reason they're raising interest rates now is because they need to stem the inflationary pass-through from the weaker currency and higher called commodity or input prices. That, as a result, is putting kind of a dimmer effect onto local markets, especially local market rates, at this moment. The good news is we expect, as we get closer to 2022, that's going to shift, because as these countries jump the rate cycle and push their interest rates up, even ahead of the U.S., and their economies are poised for a very strong 2022. I mean, look, we're still going to see a strong 2021, but many of these economies are going to see a strong 2022. We don't expect China to fall off a cliff. We think it's going to slow down its recovery, but it's still going to recover. It's still going to be growing. But the U.S. will turn. The EC will turn. As a result, you're going to see these wider growth differentials, higher interest rates, which is going to naturally attract capital. So 2022, 23, will be very good years for local markets. But we got to get through this moment. And we're coming, and this moment is weaker currencies, big output gaps, and a need to raise interest rates to stem inflationary pass-through pressure.
That's a really nice and rich response. I'm wondering, just as we're talking about EM central banks and their policy response, one of the things that I was particularly interested in, like around this time last year, is that a lot of EM central banks were sort of borrowing from the developed market 2008 playbook and started doing QE. So you had asset purchase programs in like Poland and Chile, I think, Indonesia, if I'm not mistaken. So a couple of these, I mean, as someone who looks at these quite closely, what was your reaction to that kind of that wave of policy innovation?
Well, I think you're exactly on point there. As they were looking at the developed market policy responses to, you know, volatility, effectively market volatility, and they reacted accordingly. Because remember, the larger local markets have large, say, banking assets and pension assets involved in government bonds. So if you're sitting in Brazil or you're sitting in Indonesia and your banking system had an enormous exposure to your government bond market, and you follow the Basel I and Basel II rules, theoretically, you could be in a situation where your banking system is insolvent, right? Because you have a volatility adjusted structure. I think the central bankers reacted very appropriately. They sensed that there was a short moment here that that could stem into a longer term financial crisis if they don't stabilize the interest rate sector immediately. And that was in the U.S., the desire to, this is my personal opinion. In the U.S. and developed markets, the desire to QE or pump money into the system through quantitative easing was a way to support growth and would not only relieve stress and volatility, but support growth, support all coming recoveries, prevent the system from freezing up. In emerging markets, forget that first part. It's really the second part. It's to prevent the financial systems from freezing up and from large pieces of the banking market becoming insolvent, right? Because remember, in emerging markets, even the big ones, a good deal of your short-term funding comes from banks. In fact, all of it really comes from banks, whether it's government or whether it's corporate. And importantly, the banking system plays a much, much bigger role in domestic financing than they do in developed markets. However, so in a sense, you say, well, why do they need QE? Because the way banks hold assets and way pension funds hold assets in these markets is a large, large chunks of the government local bond market. If you mark those assets down, and there was, and I don't know if you recall, there was talk that these assets would get marked down and then these banks would be insolvent, that would freeze up the financial system. I think the central bankers were very well aware of that. Keep in mind, central bankers in most emerging markets, whether it's Brazil, Mexico, or Indonesia, the crucible of their experience, of their background, was the 98 financial crisis in emerging markets. You know, Mexico, obviously, they refer back to 94 like it was, you know, 2 days ago. But in general, whether it's 94 or 98, if your frame of reference is a freezing of your financial sector, and its subsequent impact, and you know your financial sector, your domestic financial sector, is much more important than ever for your local market, you're naturally going to react to make sure that that financial doesn't freeze. So, yes, they took a page out of the developed market QE playbook, but it's really for stabilization. Hence, two things. Not every country did it, if you notice. The countries that didn't need to do it didn't. Secondly, and this is important, they stopped it as soon as possible. Because they didn't want to actually get that much government involvement in the market. They didn't want to expend credibility in that sense. And they sensed there was a lot of monetary based liquidity running around. So you look at what they've done. They've actually, they curtailed as soon as they felt they could, as soon as flows resumed. Unlike, say, developed markets, which don't really need to curtail those programs with the same level of urgency.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I wonder, I mean, since we're talking about kind of the risk of financial freezing, that's kind of on the policy side, one of the big risks. One of the things that I wanted to sort of get your view on is, you know, as an investor, say you're CalPERS or, you know, a central bank reserves manager somewhere, when you're investing in emerging market fixed income, what are some of the main risks that you would take into account? So, I mean, obviously for you guys, I don't know if you hedge your local currency exposure at all. But I know that often in this context, people talk about, you know, rollover risk in the FX swap market. There's also been a lot of discussion about kind of illiquidity risks arising from ETFs. What are some of the systemic market risks that you see, in this space?
Well, the systemic market risk, there's a couple of emerging market specific risks, such as the deterioration of overall asset quality. In other words, we have been watching, you know, we thought in late 19 that after a number of years of deterioration, emerging market ratings, upgrades versus downgrades had finally flipped back to the more upgrades versus downgrades. Obviously 2020 put paid to that notion quite quickly. So we're still in that phenomenon of deteriorating credit quality. Debt GDP ratios, et cetera, have markedly deteriorated. And that is the fundamental for an investor. The fundamental measure of risk still is your leverage ratio, your debt GDP ratio. We all know that, I mean, I don't think it's a surprise to say, emerging markets in general have lower debt GDP ratios than you would see in the U.S. or Europe. But that doesn't matter because U.S. and Europe are not in the same stage fact that, you know, if you could even say that, like, for instance, Japan is not even a capital importer. These markets are capital importers, so they need that leveraging ability. So the dump in debt GDP ratios was probably one of the biggest factors. And you can, if you go down and you talk to the Brazilians, they focus a lot on that debt GDP ratio. They're perfectly cognizant that that is a primary concern of foreign investors, not just in debt, by the way, but also in equities, et cetera. Because the joke we have, and here's the thing, in when you talk to CalPERS, we're not fooling ourselves to say that an emerging market asset does not have sovereign risk. Whether it's an equity, whether it's a bond, whether it's an office building or a toll road, there's sovereign risk in these assets. So as a result, that debt GDP ratio and the other factors that drive liquidity in that market, current account, a growth, et cetera, it's all embedded. So that's one of the biggest factors has been the deterioration of these debt metrics, deterioration of these country credit metrics, and as a result, deterioration of credit ratings. Now we'll see if that reverses next year. Systematically and historically, the biggest issue in emerging markets is consistently the same, is the delivery of investor-friendly policy frameworks. So the old thing is, like, if you can take a country that has extremely open politics, very nice rule of law, very good in terms of, like, low corruption, et cetera, but can be a fiscal and financial basket case. Like, that'd be like a Costa Rica, right? Which is, let's face it, it hits all the metrics on so many factors, but because it's unable to deliver a coherent fiscal and financial framework, it's a B minus credit. On the flip side, you can take a country that doesn't have, you know, open rule of law, it has corruption issues, but manages to deliver a pretty consistently attractive fiscal and financial framework, and we all know who those are, is a consistent attractor of foreign capital. That happens. And I think that's what we have to focus on. That's the one thing that when we look at our metrics, so look, we rerun all the rating systems. We know all the quantitative metrics on ratings, and we run them ourselves. But we have to recognize there's a soft factor, which is how reliable is this government able to deliver on investor-friendly financial and fiscal and policy framework. And let's take another example of a problematic system, or it could be theoretically a problematic system like Mexico, where, let's face facts, the government of Mexico has consistently delivered an attractive fiscal and policy framework. Now, we can argue about growth. We can argue about what that means. You can even argue about privatizations and those kind of priorities. And those are issues. However, from a foreign investor point of view, Mexico has delivered. It's delivered on a tight fiscal plan. It's consistently fulfilled obligations for financial policy, and it has a central bank willing to take on the risks, despite everything, of maintaining a stable inflationary outlook. So what's to complain about? I mean, obviously, I would love to see more growth, but they are delivering an investor-friendly framework. That's what we need to focus on. That's the qualitative, unquantifiable issue in emerging markets that we all have to keep an eye on.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Especially, I mean, the emphasis on independent, on a sort of an independent and broadly inflation targeting central bank is not surprising, but still really interesting to hear that emphasized. Kind of more to get more in the weeds about how specifically you guys manage it. So can you walk us through kind of what your team, how your team kind of manages your EM debt exposure? So I'm assuming you guys cover sovereign, corporate, and inflation linked fixed income. And do you manage it all in house, or do you guys rely on external asset managers or give them mandates at all? What's your kind of process as a team?
Well, just to begin with, in terms of how the fund works versus the external management, roughly 95% of our fixed income assets are managed in house. we tend to use external managers as support structures. In other words, you know, we go to external managers because, you know, we have a certain amount of money we're running in-house. Let's say that's $3 billion, I don't know, whatever it is. And we might hire an external manager for $500 million. No, the joke is a fund like CalPERS or any large fund you talk to can write a check for $1 billion tomorrow, and that manager can make 200 basis points over the benchmark, and that's roughly, you know, one basis point to the bottom line. It means nothing, that excess return. However, what that manager can do to support CalPERS' mission, its internal management, et cetera, is how we cement the relationship. That's what we consider to be the purpose of that external manager relationship. But we generally manage all our assets in-house. We actively manage fixed income. There's a couple reasons for that. One of them, of course, being that unlike equities, there's a lot less efficiency to the emerging, to the fixed income benchmarks. So it's very hard to find any fixed income ETF, much less emerging market ETF, that doesn't underperform its benchmark by 20 to 25 basis points at least. I think in the end, it can be as high as 50 basis points. That's because of the inefficiency of the marketplace. So we view active management as a way we can sort of make up the gap, and we've been very successful in that. I think the other part is, you know, how we do it is we actually start with a sovereign credit analysis. In other words, we view everything in emerging markets as starting with a sovereign credit. So whether you look at local markets, you look at inflation assets, or you look at equities, or as I said, you look at infrastructure and real estate, it all starts with the sovereign credit analysis. And sovereign credit spreads are all part of that, of every investment. So the primary goal is to rank attractiveness of countries by its macro credit risk. We run a series of macro fundamental analysis, if you want to call it that. It's a quantitative structure. We use a lot of models to help us do that. It's not dissimilar to something you might see at a rating agency. I myself think from that background. If you look at what a rating agency does, there's a quantitative framework, and we run a very similar quantitative framework. I would bet you money that if you went to any asset manager out there in emerging markets, they'll give you the same story. It starts with the quantitative framework. As a result of that quantitative framework, we can actually start looking at countries' quality. We can predict its future quality, and we can actually compare them to each other. So if you think of it of, you know, a minimum quality we're looking for in this quantitative framework, then we can forecast that going forward. And then, of course, we can rank those countries versus each other from, like, countries we love to countries we're not really that interested in. After that, it's a matter of filling in each asset structure. Now, I don't want to be too flippant about it. It's not like we're saying, okay, I like Brazil, I hate the bonds, I'm going to buy the equities. We're not doing that, or at least not yet. However, what we are doing is allowing for, you know, if we like a country, we can like it across the firm. And to the extent I think we're going to be moving into in the future saying, okay, what is the best approach to filling the gap in the asset? What we do in fixed income is very straightforward. If we like a country and we can actually use our investment structure or our macro process to identify countries we like, countries we favor, and then we find the asset in our universe, it's called fixed income, to fill that risk bucket. So going back, let's say we like Colombia. I'm not saying we do. I'm just saying let's say we did. Then we might look at the Colombian local market versus the Colombian dollar market. And we might look at the correlations there. And we might find, okay, which asset fills that like bucket the best, and we can use the volatility to help us weight the asset in the portfolio, or weight the risk exposure in the portfolio. Now that's kind of a inside baseball level type analysis, but let me put to you very broadly is that we focus on risk. We don't focus on returns. Returns are unpredictable in our view. I mean, that's our philosophy. I'm sure some people out there are predicting returns and very well. We are not. What we're focusing on is targeting a risk level and then using the assets to hit that risk level. So if I want to see, and let's just take a simple example, tracking error. Say we want to put 75 basis points of tracking error in the portfolio. That's our target. because maybe we're showing a 0.5 information ratio. Every asset in the portfolio and every excess or underexposure has to fill that risk target, has to hit that contribution to risk target. And whether you use covariance matrix or whatever, it's all going towards that. So we can actually go into Israel and say we like Israel, but we don't like the local bonds hedge versus the dollar bonds, or maybe we just like the construct of the Israel bonds, local bonds and the currency. We can actually do that. We're actually doing that kind of investing. I think the other part is we're looking at overall, let's call it scenario risk to crisis, which is what we saw last March. And in that sense, we're using, like everybody else, we're ditching the covariance matrix, right? And we're looking at things like duration times spread, which basically ditches the covariance matrix, assume everything has a one correlation, and what is your risk? That actually helps us a lot in understanding what our potential downsides. And quite honestly, that's what helped us quite a bit last March, why we were able to maintain reasonable returns on an alpha basis through March. We actually had a decent March in alpha space, even though the underlying portfolio got slammed because we were actually paying attention to our correlated risk and allowed us dry powder to take advantage of those markets. But that's, the history. We'll see if we can do that in the future. Risk, constructing risk in the portfolio, and then what do disasters look like? Remember, our philosophy of emerging markets is basic. For emerging markets represent a coupon. They're not treasuries. And if the old saying about what I take from the private markets is recognize you're collecting a coupon. Recognize that, if nothing happens, you make money. You make alpha. So in that sense, your chief job as an emerging market investor is to avoid landmines, avoid pitfalls, avoid disasters. You avoid disasters consistently, you're going to be a top quartile investor. If in your process, you can identify one or two diamonds in the rough per year, that's top decile. And that's really all you need to do. Now, I can be flippant about it, right? But that process is essentially what we spend all our time trying to figure out, perfect, advance, evolve, whatnot.
Yeah, that's interesting what you said about the focusing on risk versus returns themselves. I mean, my impression of return targets for pension funds like CalPERS were always that they were, always more of an input than anything else. But I guess it would be hard to kind of reverse engineer a portfolio based on that. On your sovereign risk and your quantitative framework around that, I'm wondering. I mean, a lot of people have been talking about ESG these days, and I've heard it come up more and more often in the context of even things like emerging market fixed income. Is that something that you guys look at all? I mean, obviously, governance is kind of an obvious one in this case, but when you're looking at like EM corporate credit, for example, do you guys factor in any ESG metrics into that space, or how do you guys approach that?
Oh yeah, we absolutely. I mean, obviously, yeah. As you said, governance has been the easy one because we've always been focused on governance, right? That we just call it something else, right? We called it a policy framework or whatever we call it in the corporate space. We called it management framework, but we've always been focused on governance. And quite honestly, I think everyone has been, at least in fixed income from what I understand. I think the other two factors are the trickier ones, a social and environmental. And social is actually easier because we actually realize, as everyone else, that after governance, which is think of it in terms of outlooks, governance is a short term thing. Without good governance, whether it's a sovereign or a corporate, you're going to have issues, and that's something you can constantly monitor. Social is your longer term exogenous risk per country. So if you've got problems in your Gini coefficient, or if a country has other social pressures, they emerge as political pressures. It's not a coincidence that Chile had a poor social score, right? And all of a sudden, great governance score, by the way, but poor social score. And so what happens? These political problems erupt. This happened before COVID, right? This was all going on before. So that social scoring factor we all recognize is your longer term political stability risk, agricultural country. And where has it emerged most recently? Peru. It had been going on for years. It didn't start with this election 2 months ago. This started years ago. So that's always been a factor and something we have to keep a mind on. Environmental is trickier because environmental is global. It's not, it is somewhat country specific, and where it breaches into the social aspects, that's like a Bolivia or an Ecuador even. But the fact of the matter is most of the environmental risks we see affecting these markets now are not something they can actually directly control. So we have to understand the impact of, say, climate change on, you know, an island producer or tourism or whatever it is. Now, we incorporate that and we are developing the models to help us deepen our incorporation of those factors. Like I said, governance factor, done. Social factor, that's pretty much done. We understand it at least, and we know how to continuously incorporate that. We know how to framework that. Environmental, we're still working on it. We have ways we gauge climate risk, and we think that's going to become more and more important. There's another sub-factor there, which, of course, is that we think that the ESG factors will become a – and this is what our longer-term goal desires – will become a way to identify investments that otherwise we would miss. And there's some investments we think coming down the pipe, which the ESG framework allows us to prioritize and get involved with before, you know, they become totally generalized into the investment universe. Sort of like getting involved with EV before, you know, California decided to stop, change its policies, right? Imagine that. That's what we are looking at. Getting involved with solar panels before, you know, PG&E said, you know, we're going to buy your excess energy. Those kind of issues, that's where we think the environmental ESG framework can actually help us make additional alpha, make additional returns, and have superior returns. Because remember, in the end, as important as ESG is to our stakeholders and to us, we have a returns obligation. We think and we're starting to see that, yes, there's a way to turn ESG goals into profits, into excess return, into stable, higher returns. Because we already know that they help us prevent exogenous tail risks, or they help us immunize or help us immunize, not completely, but help us immunize the portfolio against exogenous tail risks. That is a well-documented factor. And I myself have actually looked into that for the fund, and it's true. It can help us identify exogenous risk. More importantly, it can actually help us find, okay, am I getting paid for that exogenous risk? An example is the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council. How come GCC issuers exhibit a spread relative to rating compared to non-GCC issuers, Saudi Arabia or Oman, as single A versus a single B? Because there's a certain ESG risk built into their factor structure. And we finally identified that's why that is. It's not that the investors think that Saudi Arabia is all of a sudden a triple B. It's that they're giving an additional risk basis for the same risk that Mexico, or rather South Korea, doesn't exhibit. Does that answer that question a little bit?
Yeah. So the idea is that basically you use ESG as a way to put your finger on exogenous shocks before they materialize. Like that's kind of the way I've understood your response.
So it's been very effective in identifying that shock. I mean, I've been surprised. I've been surprised how, you know, because, you know, you sit around and wonder, well, why is Saudi giving such a premium to South Korea? Well, there's a reason for it. And guess what? Here's the reason. The same way Russian assets have a premium over similarly rated or even lower rated assets, right? Because there's political risk there. And we understand that. Bingo. It all comes out in the wash.
That's really interesting. That's something to keep in mind as people kind of try to unpack the way ESG will shape markets in the future. I mean, one thing that I've been interested in is kind of the impact of climate change on long-term interest rates, and whether kind of there's excess savings building up as a result of climate risk and whether that's driving down neutral rates. So there's a lot to unpack.
I do think, you know, I would like to say, you know, our outlook on emerging markets, you know, is definitely on the upswing. We definitely see improvements happening in the pipeline. We're probably a little bit more optimistic about the outlooks than, you know, people sitting even here 6 months ago. We are cautious about the politics this year, et cetera, and this is normal. But we're actually pretty optimistic about the recovery ratios we should see in next year. Now, obviously, there's exogenous risks that I'm not qualified to talk about, whether it's COVID or whatever. And who knows? I mean, it's not like I can sit around and predict what's going to happen. However, all things being equal, and assuming we don't get another wave of exogenous shock, we're pretty optimistic about the outlooks here. We see big recoveries coming. We see a consolidation of policy frameworks. We've been very pleased about the way central banks have reacted, even under stressful political situations. They've reacted extremely well to the policy stresses and to produce consistently investable environments, which allows investors like ourselves to essentially fund their growth and actually share in those profits.
Thanks for listening in today. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Scott. It was really great hearing him dissect the different features of emerging market fixed income, how CalPERS thinks about that asset class, how they evaluated the responses to the COVID shock over the course of 2020, and where they see the emerging market fixed income space going.
OMFIF is producing the 8th annual Global Public Investor Report devoted to best practices in public sector asset ownership and management. The global launch on July 21st hones in on a number of themes around public investment,